This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1028, a conversation with Glenn Greenberg, creator commentary on Star Trek Untold Voyages. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. This is episode 1028. It's a very special episode. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. I'm very excited today to welcome back to the show Glenn Greenberg. This is another creator commentary episode. I guess the last one he was on was episode 1007. That was from September 2023. That one was a conversation with Glenn Greenberg, creator commentary on Spider-Man, the Osborn Journal, which was very exciting. This time around, we have him instead talking about, or sorry, he's doing a creator commentary on Star Trek Untold Voyages. This is a miniseries that happened back in 1998 when Marvel still had the Star Trek license. So Glenn wrote a book at that particular time. So we really get into the weeds in here about, you know, how this book came to be, you know, how he was working on it, what it was like kind of working on these characters, and some of the specific stories. Unfortunately, it is a little bit difficult to find. Well, yes and no. You can find the issues in back issue bins, etc. I actually have to thank Glenn for being able to bring together some of these issues so I could actually read the entire series so that we could talk about it. Although I think I do mention this during the conversation. But Glenn, you know, really does a great job with this. It's a really fun read, some really great character work. You have some brilliant artwork by Michael Collins. We talk about him as well. Letter art is by Chris Eliopoulos. I mentioned this specifically because I'm actually going to be talking with Chris soon. So I'll make sure to bring it up that he worked on this particular book during this stage of his career. But this was a really great conversation. I should also mention that Tim Tui was the editor of Untold Voyages, who was also a previous guest on the show. Anyways, without further ado, we will get into the show, but you must know. I was going to say you have to know. If you would like to email me, you can do so at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. Rate the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts and also listen to us on Spotify. Upcoming episodes, we have Michael Urie coming back to the show in the next couple of weeks. He's going to be talking about Back Issue Magazine as well as a recent book that he wrote about. It was the Superhero Team-Up Companion. So we really kind of talk about those two different projects. It was a great conversation. I love having Michael on the show. This will be his second time on the show, but he's just got so many great insights, and I just love Back Issue Magazine. I regret that I was so late coming to the party. Like, I don't think I even saw Back Issue until like somewhere in the, you know, hundreds, shortly after issue 100. I was at my comic book store. And I guess I just didn't even know it existed. And I feel so embarrassed to say that. And I remember picking up an issue and being like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then trying to get my hands on other issues. Now in Canada, it's a little bit harder because, if you order it directly from Tomorrow's, unfortunately, the international shipping is insane. Something that Glenn Greenberg knows a little bit about now, as he, when he was sending me some comics, he discovered that, oh my God, shipping to Canada is nuts. Which it very much is. But I got into Back Issue Magazine. I own a lot of them digitally. I get them now. I'm able to, you know, get them at my comic store. They order them for me. I love Back Issue Magazine, so I'm really excited to present that conversation in a few weeks with Michael Urie. We're hoping to have Judd Winnick back on the show because there's an upcoming new release for in his Hi-Lo series that I'm very excited to talk to him about. As I mentioned, Chris Eliopoulos. Hopefully we'll be sitting down with the show shortly. So a lot of good stuff. Plus we have Book of the Month Club is having a new episode for February. It's coming out next week on the 24th, where we'll be talking about Spider-Man Life Theft, or really more accurately, Spider-Man Life Theft / Pursuit / Shrieking, which is the last three kind of main storylines in Amazing Spider-Man before the Clone Saga really got underway back in 1994. I'm having a blank. I'm pretty sure it's 94. Anyways, I have prattled on for 4 minutes. You're here to listen to Glenn Greenberg talk about Star Trek Untold Voyages, and let's get right into it. Enjoy. Glenn, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Adam. It's always a pleasure. Absolutely. I mean, you're I'm going to call you the patron saint of this podcast because you brought the whale home. I finally was able to talk to Mark Bagley. I owe it all to you.
Well, I always think of Ron Frenz as the patron saint of this podcast. I'm very happy to have brought you and Mark Bagley together. He's a great interview, as I'm sure you've experienced now, full of great information and just great to talk to.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I feel like he hasn't done a lot of long form interviews, if any. So it's rarefied air. So I'm only breathing it in because of you. So I thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Anything I can do to help your podcast, I'm happy to do.
So today we're here to talk about Star Trek Untold Voyages. We talked about it in our last episode we did together. Now, in case we get kind of people who are just here for Star Trek talk and want to kind of and not necessarily go back to listen to all your other interviews, although they should. can you remind us what your first kind of experience was with Star Trek?
Sure. I have an older brother and an older sister, and they were, I guess you'd call them first generation Trekkies. You know, they watched the show when it was originally broadcast. And so, when it was in reruns in the 1970s, and I was a little kid, I used to fight with them every night because they'd want to watch Star Trek. It was on at dinner time, and they'd want to watch Star Trek. I'd want to watch the Brady Bunch, which was on another channel. And because I was the baby in the family, I usually would win, much to their dismay. So I was not, you know, I didn't really gravitate towards Star Trek at first. I believe my first exposure to Star Trek, aside from my brother and sister watching it, was the animated series in the early to mid 70s. But I didn't remember much about it. But what happened was, I would say around 1978-79, I started to get a little bit more into it. And then my sister took me to see Star Trek, the motion picture, in the theater. So we're talking late 79, early 1980. And that is where it all began. I liken it to a great first date. and so after Star Trek, the motion picture, I started watching the original Star Trek series, the reruns, whenever it was on, and I started buying, you know, the novels. Pocketbooks launched a series of paperback novels to coincide with the first movie, and then Marvel started publishing a comic book series taking place right after the first movie. So I bought that as well. So before I knew it, I was like knee deep in Star Trek, and what really, really brought it all home, which like, you know, was like I said, Star Trek, the motion picture was, if Star Trek, the motion picture was like a great first date, I knew I was in love when I saw Star Trek II. that just changed my life in many, many ways. It absolutely made me a devoted Star Trek fan. It also led to me wanting to become a writer in many ways. That script that was, even though he's not credited, Nicholas Meyer is you know, so not chiefly responsible, or primarily responsible for the script that we know as Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, and that was just that made me want to write my own stories, my own Star Trek stories, and eventually, of course, I went on to write more than just Star Trek stories. As a fan, as a kid, I would write my own comic book stories and stuff, and and it started with Star Trek, and then I started to do Star Wars and all the stuff that, you know, that would really set me on a path to becoming a professional writer. So that's how I got into Star Trek. It was a long kind of road, but if I have to pick like the turning point, it was Star Trek, the motion picture, which ironically enough is most people's, you know, one of their least favorite Star Trek movies.
It's interesting that you got to kind of experience it. Like, I came to it obviously much later because I was born in 83, so I didn't have these options.
Right.
So my experience with the movies is more kind of scattershot. Like, eventually I watched them all, but yeah, it was definitely out of order, although I think I saw 6 in theaters, which, looking back, I was probably too young to see it in theaters. I was like, right, maybe 8.
Yeah.
But for me, that's funny because then I love 6. 6 is my favorite. I enjoy them all, but there's something, sure, about 6 for me.
Well, it's similar with James Bond. I didn't see the James Bond movies until the first one that I saw in the theater was Moonraker, which is not by any means considered one of the better ones, but I have a real fondness for it because it was the first one that I saw in the movie theater. And it wasn't until I was about 15 or 16 that I saw my first Sean Connery James Bond movie. So I really was going scattershot, you know what I mean? I gained a whole new appreciation. And once I saw a Sean Connery James Bond movie, I was like, Roger Moore, ha, you know. so I was able to go back and appreciate and see the greatness of those original Connery movies. So with Star Trek, the funny thing is because the James Bond movies, none of them really lead into each other back in the old days. Where Star Trek, I mean, you got to watch 2, 3, and 4 in that order to really sort of appreciate the saga.
Absolutely.
But I can understand, like, you know, you get around to the first movie, the motion picture, and you're probably like, wow, this is really different. This is really out of step with all of the others.
Mm-hmm. I think that is my take on it. It's funny. Yeah. My son has seen the first one, and I was talking to him yesterday. I'm like, you know, after my podcast, we should really watch Star Trek 2. And he's like, why? And I'm like, well, wow, it kind of leads into what I'm about to do with this guy who wrote this comic and the set between motion picture and the second one. He's like, oh, okay, maybe. And I'm like, okay, but like, I'm really, really pushing it.
Yeah.
I got to make this happen.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those things where you had to be there, you know, and there was like a 10-year wait for this crew, this cast to come back. And there had been so many rumors and so many false starts and so many stops, and it was going to be another TV show and there was going to be a movie. No, it's back to being a TV show. No, it's back to being a movie. So, you know, it was such a long and winding road to get to that movie. And so when you finally get to see it, and you see how beautifully it was crafted. I mean, it's a beautifully crafted film. I mean, the special effects are terrific, and it's great to see those characters again. And also, it was coming in the wake. I mean, even though it was about 10 years earlier, 11 years earlier, it's coming in the wake of really intelligent science fiction like 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was an influence on this movie. That's what they were basically trying to do Star Trek as 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
And that was the influence at the time. They wanted to do it as serious science fiction. And the movie did well. It did well financially. It wasn't a critical bonanza, but it did well financially, and they just decided that maybe we went a little too far in the cerebral vein, and we kind of have to get back to what people loved about the original series, which was the characters and the warmth and the camaraderie. And that was the takeaway, because that really what was missing to a certain extent in the motion picture, the warmth between the characters. They were trying to find their way back to themselves, and that doesn't really happen until the end of the movie.
No, I suppose that's true. So I guess my next kind of natural question is, you know, when Marvel gets the license back in the late 90s, I can't remember the chronology, so forgive me. Are you still on staff at this point, or are you freelancing at this point?
Oh, no. I was well on staff at that point.
So what was it? What was your feeling when, you know, they had the kind of sub, I guess it was like a sub imprint, the Paramount Comics? Like, what was your take on it when Marvel got that license back?
I was mixed because DC had done such a good job with the Star Trek comic books for about 12 years. I think they got the license in 83, 84, and they lost it in 95, 96. So I was like, you know, I was like kind of regretful, just because I thought DC had done such great things with those Star Trek titles. But I was also excited about the possibilities of what we could do with them. I would have loved to edit some of them, but at that point, I wasn't in a position to I think, if I remember correctly, I was still an assistant editor at that time. So I wouldn't have been in a position to edit them on my own. But, I mean, I would have loved to. And I don't even think – once we got the license, I don't think it immediately entered my head that I would, you know, end up writing any of them. I don't think it was really something that I was thinking about at the time. But I was wondering, you know, who would we get? You know, who would we get to write these things? Who would we get to draw them? When will the books take place? And what books are we going to do? Like, what are going to be the concepts behind each book? So it was intriguing. I know that we also made a bid to get Star Wars back from Dark Horse, but Dark Horse held on to the license for many years after that. In fact, you know, Dark Horse didn't lose the license until after Disney bought Lucasfilm.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And Disney already owned Marvel, so it made sense to give Marvel back the Star Wars license. But in the 90s, around the time that that we got the Star Trek license, I know we were also looking at trying to get Star Wars back. The other thing about – this goes into some really behind-the-scenes stuff, but the other thing about getting the Star Trek license was, you know, we were experiencing some turmoil at Marvel at the time. We lost four of our big titles, essentially. We lost Iron Man. We lost Captain America, Fantastic Four, and Avengers. We basically subcontracted them or licensed them out to Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee. So we were losing books, and that could mean, you know, we'd have to cut staff. So getting the Star Trek books was kind of like a blessing in that, you know, people who lost some of their titles that they were editing will now have titles to replace them. And so it was a good way to keep the staff that we had and not have to contract any further, so people didn't have to lose their jobs.
Besides, obviously, Untold Voyages, what was – I mean, I guess there was Starfleet Academy, there was Early Voyages. Which was your favorite between those two?
Between those two, with all due respect to my good friend Chris Cooper, between those two is Early Voyages, because I always liked Captain Pike. I was intrigued by him. I was intrigued by stories set aboard the Enterprise before Captain Kirk, also featuring a young Spock, to see how Spock sort of develops into the character that we would know better from the TV series. So that was one. Plus, I thought the art was really strong. I liked the stories that they were doing. Starfleet Academy, you know, the whole concept of Starfleet Academy isn't one that really interests me as much as a more seasoned, established crew going out there and having adventures. I'm just not that interested in you know. I guess you could say I'm not as interested in kids in Star Trek. You know, I wasn't a big Wesley Crusher fan. Although I felt bad for Will Wheaton. I mean, he took a pounding from the fans. I don't think he should have gotten so much abuse, but Wesley was an annoying little brat. and so the concept of Starfleet Academy wasn't as interesting to me. If that's not any reflection of the quality of the work or the effort that was put in. It just was a concept that I was less interested in.
Now, obviously, the editor of Untold Voyages was Tim Tui, who was obviously part of that kind of cohort of editors at that time and staffers. Yeah. So What was it like? I mean, I guess when Tim started editing what became this book, I guess at what point did you become involved in – were you pitching this? Like at what point was Untold Voyages show up?
That's a very funny story. What happened was Bobby Chase was editing – some of the Star Trek books, and Tim was editing some of the others. Mm-hmm. And what happened was Tim and I were both editors on staff. I think I might have still been an associate. No. By that point, I was an associate editor. Yes. So I was editing my own titles at that time. So what happened was Tim was working late one night, and I was working late, and I wandered into his office. And we were just shooting the breeze. We were just like, you know, how's it going? What are you up to? What are you working on these days? What are you working on these days? You know, we were just like catching up, you know, really just kind of chewing the fat. And I just remember sitting back in a chair across from his desk. You know, I might have had my feet up on his desk or whatever. You know, we were just casually talking. And I said to him, I said, you know what you ought to do? I said, remember the old Marvel series where, you know, and just to give you a little bit of backstory, if you weren't aware of this, Adam, mm-hmm. one of the problems that the original Marvel comic book series of Star Trek, the one from 1980 to 82, they were hobbled by a really restrictive contract. The contract limited Marvel only to concepts, characters, events, and history established in Star Trek the Motion Picture. So they couldn't really refer to a lot of the stuff from the TV series, you know? So mm-hmm. they couldn't bring back characters from the TV show. They couldn't bring back Harry Mudd or Cyrano Jones or the Tribbles or, because Klingons appeared in Star Trek the Motion Picture, they could use Klingons in the comic book, but they couldn't use Klingons from the TV series. No, they couldn't bring back Commander Kor or Commander Kang or Captain Koloth or they couldn't use the Romulans because the Romulans weren't in Star Trek the Motion Picture. They weren't referred to in Star Trek the Motion Picture, but they could use Andorians, you know, or any of the other alien races that appeared in that movie. So that kind of like really limited a lot of the stuff that they could do. So I said to Tim, I said, we're not under those restrictions, you know. What you should do, and I kept saying what you should do to him. Like I'm just feeding him an idea. I wasn't, lobbying. I said to him, what you ought to do is, I said, even if it's just a limited series, why don't you do the Marvel series, the old Marvel series, do it right. Set it after Star Trek the Motion Picture, and you've got the whole Star Trek history, you know, to play with. I said, so you can bring back characters. You can do sequels to old episodes. And I said, why don't you do – so he's like looking at me going, uh-huh, uh-huh. I said, let's say you do it as a 5-issue limited series. Well, what if after the motion picture, Kirk did another 5-year mission like on the original TV show? They do a 5-year mission, do a 5-issue limited series. Each issue goes 1 year deeper into the 5-year mission. And he's like, go on. And I said, and since we know – what happens to these characters after Star Trek the Motion Picture, you can start planting the seeds for what we know will happen to them. So, for example, let's say in the first issue you focus on Kirk and it's him sort of getting his mojo back. He's feeling a little bit rusty because he hasn't commanded a ship in a while. He's challenged. He has a real challenge, and he has to go through this whole crisis to get himself sort of back into speed. And then in the second issue, you can deal with Spock and how he met Lieutenant Savick, because they have this long-standing relationship in Star Trek II. We never saw her before. So, you could do a personal story about Spock. In issue number 3, do a personal story about Dr. McCoy and the daughter that we know he has. But, there hasn't been any really good stories with her. Let's do the definitive story about Dr. McCoy's daughter. And then in the 4th issue, we could focus on the supporting cast, and we know that Sulu is going to become captain of the Excelsior in Star Trek VI. What if we show the first adventure where he really decides he wants to, start working towards becoming a captain? And in the 5th issue, it's the end of the second 5-year mission, we can show why Kirk returned to being an admiral, which is where we see him at the beginning of Star Trek II. And Tim is like going, mm-hmm. I'm thinking we could show the transition from the motion picture uniforms to the uniforms that they wore in Wrath of Khan, and you could do this and you can do that. And we started joking around. I said, you could call it Star Trek, and Tim goes, Star Trek The Great Pajamas Saga. You know, because those gray uniforms that they wore in the motion picture. And I was like, oh, that's funny. I said, we could call like maybe Star Trek The Secret Voyages or Star Trek, you know. And he said, Untold Voyages. I said, yeah, well, let's call, you know, you could call it Untold. I said, but, you know, there's all this stuff you can do. And I said, you're the guy to do it because you know, to edit it because you're the, you know, you know all this stuff. So he's like looking at me. He's got this really sort of like, you know, sort of wicked looking grin on his face. I'm like, what? He goes, what are you sitting here for? Go home and write up a pitch. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, why not? And I was like, but I wasn't here pitching for myself. He goes, just go home and write up a pitch. So I went home and I wrote up a pitch. And I wrote this whole overview and I wrote possible storylines for each issue. Tim loved it. And Tim sent it to Paramount. And before I knew it, Paramount gave us an approval. They had some qualms about one or two of my story. I think just the first issue. I think if I remember correctly, the first issue was the one that they really wanted me to sort of rethink. But other than that, they were on board for most of it. And we were off and running. And that's, you know, it's one of those things where I was just sort of trying to help a friend, you know, and a colleague, you know, saying, you know, you should do this. You should do this kind of thing. This is what I would love to see you do. And he turned around and said, well, I want you to do it. So that's how it happened.
Was he, how much of a Star Trek fan was Tim?
Huge, huge.
More than you? Know, you?
Well, I'm sorry?
I said more than you?
I would say that Tim's knowledge of Star Trek probably exceeds mine because he's a little bit more broad-minded when it comes to Star Trek. I like The Next Generation just fine. You know, I think once it hit its you know, its sweet spot, it became a really, really good show. But I don't love The Next Generation. I never loved it. I never watched it over and over and over again and soaked up all of the minutiae. Deep Space Nine, I only watched like maybe the first three and a half seasons. So Tim has more knowledge of post original series Star Trek. So just as he may kill me for telling this story, but we were all at a friend's house one night watching an episode of Deep Space Nine. This would have been when I was still watching Deep Space Nine. We were all at a friend's house, and some enemy race or whatever said that, you know, or that there was an enemy race that was on a direct course for, you know, for a certain location, right? And the heroes from Deep Space Nine were basically saying, you know, we've calculated they're on a direct course for coordinates 000 mark 0. And I had no idea what that meant. And Tim gasped. And he's like, oh my God, they're headed for Earth. And then like a minute later on the show, they were like, that's Earth, you know? And I like looked at Tim and I'm like, don't you ever call me a geek again, you know? So that's, you know, that's how much Tim, you know, is. I don't know if that makes him a bigger fan than me, but I would say he's more knowledgeable than I am in some capacities.
When he's editing those books, was there any part of you was like, oh man, I wish I was editing these?
No, no writing. You know, I wrote in my first script, the first script that I turned in, I wrote, you know, in the opening paragraph, you know, Captain Kirk standing on the bridge of the Enterprise. And I was like, somebody pinch me. I can't believe this is happening. You know, there's nothing like writing those characters. Editing would have been fine. Editing would have been fine, but I was chomping at the bit. I mean, in some ways, this was the job that I've been waiting my whole life to do. Because, like I said, once I saw Star Trek II, I started writing my own Star Trek comic books, you know, writing and drawing. And, you know, I always fancied the idea of writing a Star Trek novel. I you know, it was always like I had a notebook and I was jot down ideas for something I could turn into a Star Trek novel. So getting to write it was, I mean, I felt like I'd had years of on the job training, really, because writing those comic book stories, those amateur comic book stories that I wrote, and, you know, coming up with those ideas for the novels that I always wanted to do. I mean, that was practice, basically. That was me honing my writing skills, so that by the time I actually was doing it professionally, I felt like I was ready.
Now, given that, I mean, Tim's the one editing it, but were you in any way involved in the kind of creation of the rest of the creative team? Or is that, did Tim take care of all? I mean, he is the editor, so it makes sense. But I'm just curious because of how you kind of came up with this project for yourself unintentionally.
Right.
So I'm curious, like, how involved were you with selecting the artist, for example?
I wouldn't have, well, that's the thing, is because this is a licensed book, I could have made suggestions, but ultimately, you know, even Tim didn't have final say. Paramount had to approve. I mean, there were a select number of artists that Paramount was going to approve of doing. You know, you had to be able to do likeness as well, and Paramount had to approve that. So I seem to remember not being too involved in the selection of the art team. I was happy with it for sure, but I don't think, like, for example, I mean, Tim was also my editor on Dracula, and with Dracula, which was another passion project of mine. And I think because Tim and I were so on the same wavelength, you know, when I pitched Pat Olive for Dracula, that was my idea. And I brought in some samples of his pages from the Frankenstein adaptation that he had done years earlier, and Tim was sold. Tim was like, great. And then I also suggested Tom Palmer to ink Pat, and Tom Palmer, as you probably remember, was the inker on Tomb of Dracula.
Of course.
So Tim loved all of my suggestions for Dracula. But that was a different project with different rules. With Star Trek, you know, again, I could have suggested anybody, but if Paramount didn't like that artist's work, that artist wasn't going to get the gig. So I tended to stay more out of that realm on Star Trek. But the people that did get chosen, I mean, who could complain?
Well, for sure. Yeah. So I'm really curious about, you know, what it was like kind of working on this license at this time. Like, when you're writing, first of all, obviously, you know, when you're writing for your artist, are you doing full script, or like how detailed are you? But I guess you probably had to be fairly detailed because you're also submitting first to the licensee before you can even get it to the artist, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I tended to write very detailed plots to begin with. And at the time, Marvel was still doing what was called Marvel style, which is plot art script. Now you know that process, right?
Of course.
Okay. So, but you know, I tended to write very tight plots so that there would be no real surprises when the artwork came. And so that way it would be easier for me to do the dialogue and the captions and all that kind of stuff. So there wouldn't be as many surprises. So I tended to write pretty tight plots. And I would also, and because of Paramount having to approve everything, I would include like sample dialogue. And some of that dialogue did end up becoming final in the script, but I would let them know what the star dates were. They looked pretty closely at the star dates to make sure that the star dates worked, you know, within the chronology and everything. So you had to be careful with that kind of stuff. So all of that was in the plots, especially with Star Trek. But I seem to remember writing pretty tight plots on everything that I wrote, except maybe there was like an issue with Silver Surfer where I loosened up a little bit because Ron Garney was drawing it. And I knew he was like – I know he really liked a lot of freedom, especially with fight scenes. So I did an issue of the Silver Surfer that Ron Garney drew. And I think I wrote like, you know, for the next six pages, Ron, have fun. It was a fight between the Silver Surfer and the Hulk.
Oh,
so
nice.
I said, just have fun. And he called me up and said, I love that, man. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, man. Really, I love that. So that was that a very rare case where I really loosened up. With Star Trek, I was pretty tight. The other thing with Star Trek, the other thing I did with Star Trek, before I even wrote the plots, I did thumbnails of each and every issue.
Oh, wow.
And I am not an I'm not an established artist. I'm not a good artist, but I wanted to make sure that everything that I wanted to do in each story was going to fit in a full issue. I wanted to make sure that everything was able to be broken down page by page. So I would figure out how many panels on each page, and I would draw like very sort of crude figures and write, you know, sample dialogue. And that's how I wrote the plots. I figured if I can get everything onto each page, and each page is no more than five or six panels, that'll be how I break down the plots. And so that's how I did it.
One thing I really appreciated reading it, and again, this is my first time actually reading it. Well, I've read it a couple times since I've now experienced it in the last couple weeks. One thing that was really struck me, especially in this day and age, is just how much you got done in each issue. And again, obviously it makes sense because your remit is to basically have each issue be, you know, a mission in a different year of this 5-year mission. But yeah. It really struck me on how much you're able to do, have a full story, you know, and it sounds so silly to say it has a beginning, middle, and end, but I just feel like modern comics, especially, you know, in even those that are licensed, they obviously pad out differently now. And so I thought it was really enjoyable to get five full stories, and it seems like a very obvious thing to say, but that's not as normal these days.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And believe me, I would have loved to have been able to do an ongoing series and do like a multi-part saga, like a 5 or 6 issue saga. And then, you know, the next issue, I would start a new story. You know, maybe that's a one-parter. And then the issue after that, I start another multi-parter. But no, that was the format. That was the pitch. And the hope was going to be that this would have led to more, and, you know, maybe an ongoing series, maybe another limited series, maybe a longer limited, maybe like a 12-issue limited series where we could have done multi-parters. It's definitely become a lost skill, I think, in today's comic book industry, to be able to do an entire story in one issue. I know that there was at least one person who had worked on the DC comic, the DC Star Trek comics, who I was out to lunch with once. This was after my comics had come out, and he was heavily involved with the DC series. And I said, "So what did you think?" I said, and he said that he said he thought I tried to do too much per issue. And he was the only person that said that. So, but he's somebody whose opinion I respect. So I'm very torn. on the one hand, I feel like I really gave the readers their money's worth, but maybe I did try to do too much. But I'm too close to it to really be able to get a clear perspective. I read them again, you know, within the last few years, and I don't know. I'm still happy with them. I'm really still happy with them for the most part. There are a few things I would change here and there, but I think it's pretty well balanced for the most part.
One thing I have a general question, which is, you know, which character's voice did you find easiest to kind of tap into? But before you answer it, I was really taken with how well you captured Spock's voice. It just something about, because I guess Spock has a very specific way of speaking and a very specific type of dialogue and vocabulary, and I thought you really nailed that interpretation. Although it's funny, and I don't know why this happened, at times I could hear Nimoy, but then I could also hear Ethan Peck from Strange New Worlds, because that's the more modern Spock I've become used to in the last couple years. So it was interesting hearing it, and at times it was almost like I was oscillating back and forth between which Spock I heard in my head. But at the end of the day, I still heard one of them, and it still sounded right.
Oh, great! I'm very happy to hear that. Well, you know, when I'm writing, you know, when I'm writing any established character, but especially with something like Star Trek, where there is a template and actors who played those roles for many, many years, I absolutely try to capture the actors' voices and, you know, the characters, the actors playing those characters. You know, as a reader, before I got to write them, it would always take me out of the book or the comic book if the writer didn't capture those voices. So I was very, very cognizant of that. And you know, there was a little voice in my head that kept on saying, you know, you better put your money where your mouth is. You better put your money where your mouth is. You've criticized a lot of novelists and comic book writers over the years because you didn't feel that they got the characters' voices right. Now's your chance. You better put up or shut up. And so that was really motivating me. And so I really strived to do that. I was very sensitive about that, actually, very sensitive about trying to get the voices right. Now, to answer your question, I mean, I tried to give everybody sort of equal, you know, equal tender, loving care, you know, but if you were to ask me, like, who did I have the most fun with, I'd say Dr. McCoy.
Hmm.
Because Dr. McCoy is the one, he doesn't, there's no false airs about Dr. McCoy. And there's no, even with Kirk, who's, you know, pretty a straightforward character to write. And you just have to sort of like picture Shatner. I mean, at that point in history, Shatner and Kirk were interchangeable. So if you're writing Kirk, you're writing Shatner and vice versa. But there is still a sort of like this, because he's the commander of the ship, there is a formal tone that he has to take in certain circumstances, especially when he's on duty. And if there's a crisis situation, he always slips into command mode and you have to write him a little bit more formal. Spock, like you said, has a certain speech pattern that, you know, if you pay attention and you really absorb it, it's easy to capture. With McCoy is like sort of anti-authority, and he talks the way a normal person would talk under very, you know, unusual or sometimes very trying circumstances. McCoy's the one that basically speaks for the audience, like, what the hell's going on around here? You know, this is insanity. You know, like, you know, Jim, what are you, crazy? You know, that kind of thing. And that's a lot of fun. He takes the air out of people. You know, he kind of like sticks a pin in all of the in all of the puffery, and that's his role. I mean, and he's the only one on the ship that can do that.
One thing I thought was interesting, and I'm curious what, as a writer, how you approached it, is obviously when you're dealing with certain characters like Chekhov and Scotty, who have, you know, obviously they have an accent or they have, you know, a certain element of their speech. Were you very aware of when not to lean into it too much? Like, you got to use it just enough, and the certain, you know, some of the letters are a little bit different because you're using different pronunciations. But were you constantly in your head about trying to make sure you didn't go too far and that it wasn't almost becoming parody? Like, I feel like that's a very fine line when you're writing it.
Yes, I was very, very aware of it, and I tried to use it effectively and only where it was suited to the moment. You know, if I was going to have, you know, Chekhov say, you know, three Klingon, you know, vessels approaching, well, he's known for saying vessels, you know, so I had to do that. But if he was like just sort of giving very straightforward information, I tried not to be too over the top with the accent, because it becomes a distraction. Same with Scotty. I tried not to go overboard, but also not to let the readers forget that these people speak with accents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very fine line.
It is. It is a very fine line.
I'm curious about one thing that made me laugh, but it was like, I was wondering, was this something that you always wanted to throw in there? Was in issue 4, when you have Chekhov basically talking about why he would know who Khan was, like it's setting up him recognizing Khan later. Was that something that had bugged you that you really wanted to add into continuity? That of course he was on the ship. This is why I would know.
It was my attempt, because ultimately it was unsuccessful because people still bring this up. But it was my attempt to shut those fans up. to shut up the fans who – okay, so Star Trek II came out in 82, and I wrote this in 97, 98. So 15 years at that point of fans saying, how could Khan remember Chekhov when Chekhov wasn't on the Enterprise during Space Seed? And my response, they screwed up. They screwed up with Star Trek II because Chekhov wasn't even on board. Walter Koenig wasn't part of the cast in the first season. Okay, well, you're right. Walter Koenig was not part of the cast in the first season. But that does not mean that Chekhov was not on board the Enterprise. We just hadn't seen him, you know. And maybe he came aboard towards the end of the first of that year, you know. Space Seed, which is the episode where Khan first appeared, Space Seed was towards the end of the first season. Okay. And if you try to try to make each season represents a year of that 5-year mission, that original 5-year mission, mm-hmm. Well, who's to say that Chekhov didn't come aboard shortly before Space Seed? We just didn't see him because, you know, he wasn't on the bridge yet. And he got his role on the ship changed, and he became a bridge crew member. The same way Sulu used to be. In the episode where No Man Has Gone Before, it was established that Sulu had a different role. I think he was like the botanist on the ship or what. I don't remember. I mean, it's my memory is starting to go a little bit when it comes to all this trivia, but Sulu had a different role. In the second pilot, which is where he first appeared, he was like a mathematician. I mean, he was much more in the sciences division, if I remember correctly, in that episode. And then he eventually gets moved to being the helmsman. Okay, so who was to say that the same couldn't happen for Chekhov? So that was my attempt to just sort of get it across to the fans that they're being a little too anal retentive and a little too pedantic and a little too literal minded. And so, yes, Walter Koenig was not there playing Chekhov in the first season, but why do you automatically assume that Chekhov wasn't there? So that was why I had that scene in issue number 4, basically just to shut everybody up. And like I said, It didn't really work because so many people still bring that up after all these years. And I see it all over the internet, and I see articles about it, and I see posts about it on Facebook and Star Trek groups and all that. And I've just basically given up at this point.
I mean, it's just because they haven't read it, right?
I guess your
rebuttal of this. I did enjoy the whole pacing of it. I thought that Collins did an amazing job at making that scene work, because there's a great beat there where you have like the dialogue and it's just them looking at him. And then this like half smirk that he puts on Chekhov is absolutely pitch perfect.
He was one of the best artists that I ever worked with. We were so in sync, and we worked really, really well together. And he is such a Star Trek maven that he was able to add in stuff that I hadn't thought of. And it really enhanced the whole thing. Little bits in the background and little doodads and stuff. Just little bits that I was like, oh, that's terrific. I love it. I love it. That, you know, and he handled that scene really, really, really well. And I still, to this day, I don't know how I got, you know, there's a line where Chekhov says, look, I was in engineering when I first came aboard. That's where Khan attacked. That's what Khan took over when he took over the ship. I was in engineering. I of course I remember Khan. And they're like, you worked in engineering? We can't picture you as anything other than navigator. And Chekhov says, I don't believe it. I've been typecast.
Yeah.
I can't believe that got approved by Paramount. I mean, to this day, I just like, wow. I was playing with fire and they let me get away with it. But it was fun. It was a good little bit, and I thought I thought it was a nice little sort of tip of the hat to poor Walter Koenig, who of course, you know, was typecast for a very long time until he got that gig doing Babylon 5, where he got to play this other really sort of, you know, juicy character named Bester that he really relished and got to sort of get out of that Chekhov trap or that mold that he was stuck in for so many years. So yeah, this it was all a little like sort of tip of the hat to that, and yeah, I can't believe they let me get away with it.
Well, speaking of lines that you're surprised they let you get away with, in issue, I guess, 5, you have, I guess McCoy does refer to the pajama uniforms. Like, he actually refers to them, it's like wearing pajamas. And I was like, well, that's, like, very on the nose, but very funny to kind of have him spell it out. Did you ever worry about that line getting through?
No, I mean, if I remember correctly, other people had done it before me.
Okay.
And it wasn't a knock at the uniforms. I mean, I love the Star Trek the Motion Picture uniforms. I wasn't meant to be a knock, and I hope it didn't come off as a knock, but I pictured it as McCoy sort of preferring the pajama uniforms, because McCoy is more casual.
True.
So he would have made that comparison, I think, and Kirk would have been there to sort of like knock him back into line and say, you know, pajamas are for sleeping and not for running a starship.
I do appreciate that, as you said before, like the delicate balance and the fun of doing a story like this is that you get to, because the audience, you and the audience know where these characters are headed, but they don't. So you're able to play with things that didn't. You know, wouldn't have known of at the time. Like, you're dealing with the fact that David exists as a character who, again, we're only introduced to him in Wrath of Khan. But here you're able to kind of explore a little bit more of Kirk's actual guilt and about not really having a relationship.
Yeah.
And what that means. And that's really meaty stuff. And it really adds a lot to the idea of him getting older and what that means. And, you know, there's this thing that people do, that they have, you know, have families and have children, and he has a child, but there's no connection there. And what is there for the next generation for him? And so it's just really meaty stuff, and you really made a nice meal out of it.
Well, thank you. I mean, that was what I was going for, obviously. And I touched upon it a little more subtly in issue number 3, when McCoy is worried about his daughter. And Kirk is, you know, he basically has this sort of, you know, I don't know if you'd call it an argument, but this little moment with Kirk where McCoy, the conflict is arising over McCoy and his daughter, and he gets into a snit with Kirk, and he says to Kirk, "You don't understand. You're not a father." And there's like this sort of beat with Kirk sort of like has this little bit of a reaction shot. And it's like he goes, "No, I guess I'm not." And then he kind of like steps back and lets McCoy just sort of like storm off. And that was sort of like a foreshadowing in some ways to what I dealt with in issue number 5.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's interesting. And again, speaking of Colin's work, that moment of realization that you mentioned that's on Kirk's face, that really sells the moment. Like, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's such a great visual beat of, you know, it's interesting because you have to, the artist has to portray it in a way that we, the audience, knows what it means.
But right.
Also that that McCoy wouldn't think it was untoward either. Like, McCoy wouldn't read anything into his face, but we read everything into his face.
Right. You know, and everything you just said. Yeah. It was fun to be able to sort of plant that seed in issue number 3 and pay off on it in issue number 5, where you get to see, you know, Kirk's thoughts about being an absentee father and knowing that he has this kid out there that he has no relationship with, and the regret and the thought that he probably never will have a relationship with this child.
For sure. I'm curious about issue 3, which is again more of the focus on McCoy and a more of a direct tie into, you know, a previous story. I'm curious about, you know, when you're breaking down these stories, obviously you're trying to kind of balance doing something new and new exploration, but also trying to do some sort of payoff to older stories. So what was that kind of give and take in your mind?
Well, like I said, I broke it down so that the order would be issue number 1 is Kirk, issue number 2 Spock, issue number 3 McCoy, issue number 4 and the rest, and issue number 5 is Kirk again. So I knew I had to do a McCoy story, and I knew I wanted to involve his daughter, who had been first mentioned in the animated series. There was an episode of the animated series where she was mentioned, and there was a novel that featured her, and the original Marvel series did an issue featuring her, and I didn't think that either of them really did the concept justice. So I wanted to do what I felt would have been the definitive story of McCoy and his daughter. But I also wanted it to, because it's about McCoy, I wanted it to be a medical crisis, you know, because that's how he can really save the day. It's a medical crisis. So the way my thinking went was, well, what if something McCoy did in the past comes back to haunt him? What if one of the cures that he came up with, what if one of the miracles that he performed in the past turned out not to be as perfect as he thought it was, you know? So at that point, I was like, well, I can do one of two things. I can have it be this unknown chapter from McCoy's past that we'd never seen before, or I can tie in to establish continuity. And given only one issue to tell my story, I felt it would have taken up too much space to have to explain this previous thing that McCoy had done that he thought he cured, and then it all unraveled. So then the natural progression then became, well, then I have to look back at the original series and see if there's any, you know, anything that McCoy accomplished in the original series that I have to now undo. and then he has to like come back and basically make up for his mistake, or make up for his error, or whatever. And so I went through every single episode again. I reviewed every single episode, and the one that I landed on was Miri, which is the one about the children who are hundreds of years old. And once they hit puberty, they start to age rapidly, and they start to they get this disease that kills them rapidly. And so McCoy came up with the cure, and the Enterprise left, and everything seemed to be hunky-dory. And so what I postulated for this McCoy story was, what if that cure, under the circumstances, everything that he did was right, but there was a couple of scientific things that he neglected to take into account, and so the whole thing started to unravel in their absence. And so now it's become like even more tragic. And that's how it just basically came about, which was, it's a McCoy story. We want it to be a medical crisis that he has to solve. But what if it's something that's like a stain, that's a stain on his soul that he has to really sort of cope with and work his daughter in while we're at it.
Was there any pushback from Paramount because you are kind of, as you said, kind of undoing one of his successes. Like, was there any pushback about that?
No. Where the pushback came from, this is another story if you've got time.
Sure.
But my idea was to basically pick up an idea that was going to be done on the original series. And it was an episode that was going to be called Joanna. And it was written by DC Fontana, who was one of the most important Star Trek writers of all time. Very important in the original series. She was basically, you know, more or less the custodian of the Spock character. And she had established the fact that McCoy joined Starfleet after his divorce, and that he had this young daughter. Well, for the third season, DC Fontana had written a script called Joanna that was going to have McCoy's daughter come aboard the Enterprise. And she was going to become sort of romantically involved with Captain Kirk. And that would have established the first real conflict between Kirk and McCoy. It would have brought this new dimension to their relationship. And so that's what happened. In the interim, Gene Roddenberry stepped down as the hands-on producer of Star Trek, and they brought in a new guy named Fred Freiberger, who wasn't as familiar with the show as either Gene Roddenberry, of course, or Dorothy Fontana. And he read the Joanna script and said that it needed major rewriting, because how could McCoy have a daughter old enough to be involved romantically with Captain Kirk when they're contemporaries? He never even read the writer's guide to Star Trek. He didn't know that McCoy is a good 10 years older than Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't even know that. So he had the script completely rewritten, and it became what is widely regarded as one of the worst episodes of the series. It's called The Way to Eden. It's the one with the hip. Do you remember the one with the hippies?
Vaguely.
Okay, the space hippies. Well, one of those space hippies was going to be McCoy's daughter. And so the whole script got rewritten. And so instead of McCoy's daughter, it becomes Chekhov's ex-girlfriend. And so she's part of this cult of hippies that take over the Enterprise and want to take it to this paradise world, nicknamed Eden. Okay, so that's where the conflict becomes. It's not between McCoy and Kirk. It's not even between Chekhov and Kirk. It's between Chekhov and this ex-girlfriend of his, this Russian girl named Irina, who is part of this cult that tries to hijack the Enterprise and take it to this forbidden world. Okay, so anyway, that's the backstory. Well, my story was going to be a little bit less explicit in terms of the relationship between Kirk and McCoy's daughter Joanna. It was going to be like a flirtation, but enough of a flirtation that McCoy gets really bent out of shape about it. Okay, but it was going to be completely innocent. Well, I get my notes back from Paramount, and they said they were very, very concerned about the age difference between Kirk and McCoy's daughter. And so they suggested, why don't I have her hook up with Chekhov instead?
Well, that's funny.
And I literally started banging my head against my desk. I was like, I don't believe this. So I wrote a detailed memo. And I used – what had just come out was a book called Star Trek, The Official Chronology. Mm-hmm. And it worked out the dates of the dates of the birth dates of all the characters and so forth and so on. And I said, look, I said, by my estimates, Kirk is about 41, 42 years old at the time of my story. And McCoy's daughter is probably around 26. So it's a 16-year age gap. I said, my sister is married to somebody who's more than 16 years older than her. My cousin is married to somebody who's more than 16 years older. Joanna is 26 in my story, more than old enough to make her own decisions, okay? I said, there's nothing scandalous. Plus, this is the 23rd century, you know? It's like it's not that big a deal. Especially if it's not that big a deal in the 20th century.
Yeah.
So I said, and plus, you know, having Chekhov get involved with McCoy's daughter just isn't going to have the resonance of there being a flirtation between Kirk and McCoy's daughter. And to their credit, and I have to give them all the credit in the world because they could have easily shot me down, they said, okay, go ahead. And I was so relieved because it would have killed the whole story in my opinion. But again, I did stress to them, there isn't going to be any relationship that we see between Kirk and McCoy. It's Kirk and McCoy's daughter. It's just a brief flirtation. And once Kirk realizes who it is, he's not going to do anything. He's not going to do anything. She might have been willing to, but there's no way Kirk would have gone there. And so they were okay with it. They felt very comfortable about it. But I could not believe that they suggested Chekhov.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because, as you said, like, you really do play it quite light. Like, it is very, like, you know, just flirtatious and nothing else. So it's funny that even that would be enough to rankle anyone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, exactly. And the way I was just going to play it was Kirk didn't realize it was her. And when McCoy shows up and he realizes it, he's kind of like mortified, if I remember correctly. You know, there's a scene where he gives her a tour of the Enterprise, but he would have done that anyway. You know, it's McCoy's daughter. You know, I'll give you a tour of the Enterprise. And when there's this scene where they're looking out at the stars and then they look at each other, yeah. I mean, the way in my mind it was, they are attracted to each other and they're completely, you know, consensual adults, and there's nothing immoral or criminal about what if they decide to pursue it, other than the fact that this is Kirk's, you know, best friend we're talking about. And so, no, he wasn't going to do it. But was he attracted to her? Sure. When he was looking out at the stars and then he turns to look at her, was he tempted? Probably. Was he going to do anything about it? Absolutely not.
In that particular issue, you do have, I mean, there is a credit there that was inspired by a story by DC Fontana.
Right.
Was that your idea to include that? Was that something legally they had to include? No. Or?
My idea. In fact, Paramount said, why is this credit in there? And I said, Joanna McCoy is DC Fontana's brainchild. And I'm playing on the whole concept of a flirtation between her and Captain Kirk. I said, she has to get credit. And they were like, okay.
Did you ever speak to DC Fontana?
No, I would have loved to.
I couldn't remember if you'd done any bookazines at that time about Star Trek that might have had you in some way connect with her at some point.
No, I mean, the bookazines didn't start until 2020, and I did speak.
True.
I did speak to George Takei for that, but no, DC Fontana. I think the only writer for the original Star Trek series that I ever interacted with was David Gerrold, who wrote the Tribbles episode. Mm. I'm now friends with Howard Weinstein, who wrote an episode of the animated series. But no, I think of the original series, the only person I ever interacted with directly was David Gerrold.
Mm. I do have to let you go soon, but I have to ask about, I mean, was it pretty important to you to include Sabek and to have more of that relationship? How important was that to you?
That was one of the first ideas I came up with when I was sitting in Tim's office. I mean, Sabek is the great question mark in Spock's life. The novelization of Star Trek II provided the bulk of Sabek's backstory. But there were still some unanswered questions that were out there. The original DC Comics series, Mike W. Barr, who was an excellent comic book writer. He was great on Batman. He was great on Star Trek. He took a stab at filling in some of Sabek's backstory, and it worked. I mean, it was an inspiration to me when I was writing my story, as was another novel called The Pandora Principle by Carolyn Close. And I took all of that stuff and tried to distill it into sort of what I felt was the most reasonable way of presenting Sabek. You know, so I felt that, you know, it would have been weird for Sabek to have been part of Spock's backstory during the original series and we didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. So my idea was, the reason why she's just kind of sprung on us in Star Trek II is because Spock didn't encounter her until after Star Trek the Motion Picture. So between that gap between the motion, so in that gap between the motion picture and the Wrath of Khan, that's when Spock met Sabek. That's, you know, when they forged their relationship, and the relationship grew during the years between motion picture and Wrath of Khan. And that, for me, that was the story to tell about Spock. That was the Spock story, was him and Sabek, and examining their relationship and why, you know, and not to sort of explain the reason, but to sort of give a really damn good reason why Sabek was openly weeping at Spock's funeral. The love between them, the bond between them. They were not just mentor and student. There was a deeper bond between them. And of course, we know how deep that bond went in Star Trek III. But yeah, I mean, she was openly weeping. And this is somebody who was like trying to pattern herself after Spock. You would think that she would want to control her emotions, but she just let it all go. She just let it all flow at the end of Wrath of Khan, where she's crying. I wanted to really sort of get into why. And the mind meld that they share at the end of my story is what really I feel in my head canon is what set that down. Yeah.
It's interesting. I feel like it was probably one of the issues that felt like it had the most – this is going to sound negative, but I don't mean it to be – the most kind of liberties with visuals that I thought – that Collins did in terms of Savick, because Savick felt very different visually and almost from like a different visual language than the rest of the crew. And maybe that was intentional, but there's just something about the way, maybe it was more at the beginning, which makes sense for how unruly she kind of was at the beginning.
Yeah.
But it was just an interesting perspective on the character. That's all, visually.
When you say that, would you mean like she was a little less sort of like defined or?
There's just something I'm thinking predominantly of, like, obviously the cover, and then also there's like the scene from the cover is also in kind of a flashback as well, and
yeah.
It's just the wildness. I guess I just didn't expect that for the character. And
it's part of the backstory that you find with her in the novels. And even in the old DC comic that I told you that Mike Barr wrote, she was feral when Spock found her. She was, I mean, you know, and she was really wild. I mean, all these children that were sort of abandoned on this Romulan colony, these half breeds, they were half Vulcan, half Romulan, and they were basically abandoned when the Romulans decided that this breeding experiment that they were doing was a failure, and they left these kids basically to fend for themselves. When they were very young. And so Savick and these other kids were extremely wild and unruly. And I think Mike did a really good job capturing that, especially on the cover.
I'm not saying he didn't do a good job. It felt almost like it was from a different universe. And I think it's because it felt more comic book action. And that didn't maybe have the same overall kind of feel of the rest of the series. And again, I didn't mean it in a negative way.
No, I don't think he would take it in a negative way. You know, the other thing was, you know, he sort of had to find a nice blend between Kirstie Alley and Robin Curtis, and have Savick be his, you know, young Savick be a believable younger version of that sort of amalgamation. And we have Savick again in the fifth issue in a sort of cameo appearance, and by that point he's sort of refining her, and Mike was sort of refining her into the character that we knew from the movies.
One thing I did like about that issue in terms of how you wrote Spock was it's kind of playing against type, because often there's just something about Spock's movements, very deliberate and very kind of straight edge and very like very much holding himself straight. And there's just something about, you have him climbing a tree and Savick's like, "You're climbing a tree." And he's like, "Believe it or not, it's not the first time." There's just something about that moment I really found endearing.
Me too. Yeah, it was a lot of fun because, I mean, I'm looking back. I don't think we ever really saw Spock interacting with a child. And other than in Miri and oh my God, I'm blanking. And The Children Shall Lead. But those were like kids that he was in conflict with. Those were kids that were throwing him and the crew into jeopardy. I'm talking about just relating basically him and a kid one on one, you know, and not a kid who's either trying to kill him or bonk him on the head. or terrify him or whatever, anything like that. Just him in one-on-one with a child, and also a child that he absolutely can relate to. You know, Savick's backstory is not all that far from Spock's in that she's a half-breed, and the other half of her doesn't control their emotions. So she's struggling. Who is she going to be? Is she going to be Vulcan or is she going to be Romulan? Well, the Romulans certainly don't want her. So she's going to have to be Vulcan. Can she do it? You know, and here is Spock, who has been through the same thing. He had to wrestle with his human half and adopted the Vulcan way. And so Savick is like, well, then that's what I have to do. And so he feels a real kinship towards her. But also he's had this experience. You have to remember, he's recently had this experience where he mind melted with V'ger. And he has accepted the importance of emotion. He has accepted his human half. And while he doesn't show it much, he has accepted that it is a part of him. And he saw how empty and how much of a void V'ger was without that human element, you know. And now V'ger had it because it melded with Decker. Decker gave it that human quality that it was missing. Spock now respects and appreciates his human half, so he can sort of let down his guard a little bit, especially with Savick, you know, who's going through this real turmoil. So yeah, he'll climb a tree, you know, and he will let down his guard, and he will mind meld with her the way his father never had with him, which is a pickup from Next Generation continuity. And we also saw flashes of it in the later movies, in Star Trek V and Star Trek VI. There's a moment where the Klingons are attacking the Enterprise, and there's a commanding Klingon aboard the Enterprise, and Spock basically tells this, you know, Klingon, you have to contact the commander of that Klingon vessel and tell him to break off his attack. And the commander is like, you know, no, he's not going to listen to me. And Spock goes, damn you, sir, you will try. And there's also the moment in Star Trek VI where Spock is so pissed off at Valeris that he smacks the phaser right out of her hand, you know. So he is more willing to let out those little emotional outbursts at the right moment at that point. And I felt like this was a good way to sort of have a precursor, is that he's not so formal and stiff when the situation calls for it.
A character I didn't know, but I guess is a pre-existing character in some way, was Ensign Omal, who you used a bunch of times, and I actually really liked every time you kind of used them. So that was a pre-existing character, correct?
Ensign Omal, as far as I'm concerned, is the ensign in Star Trek the Motion Picture, depending on which version you see. He's not in the theatrical version, but he's in the ABC TV cut, okay. and he's in the director's cut, both of which are my preferred cuts. And what happens is Kirk comes aboard in Star Trek the Motion Picture. He takes over the Enterprise, and he leaves the bridge, and Sulu says, well, he wanted her back. He got her. And there's this alien ensign who goes, and what about Captain Decker? He's been with this ship every minute of her refitting. And Uhura basically smacks him down to size. And she goes, Ensign, our chances of returning from this mission in one piece may have just doubled. That's Ensign Omal. Now, there is a novel that also purports to use the same character and gives him a completely different name and backstory. But as far as I'm concerned, Ensign Omal is the alien ensign from Star Trek the Motion Picture, early in the movie. And you could see him at the end of the movie too. He's the ensign that when they come back to the Enterprise from V'ger, Kirk takes off his field jacket and gives it to Ensign Omal.
That's funny. So was it important to you to have, like, I guess, did you feel like you needed another character? And so this is the character that you would kind of fashion for yourself, like taking from there? Or like, what was that genesis of that idea?
I thought he was an interesting looking character. I wanted to have extra ties to the motion picture era. before we start to transition to the Wrath of Khan in issue number 5, we start planting the seeds for Wrath of Khan. So I try to have as much motion picture stuff in there in those first 4 issues as possible. Whenever the situation called for it. If I could have squeezed in Chief DeFalco, who's also in Star Trek: The Motion Picture, I would have included her too.
I did appreciate that, you know, in that first issue, especially, like, as you said, it's right after V'ger, so they're constantly referencing it. Like, it's interesting because that never gets brought up anywhere else. No one ever mentions V'ger, right? So it felt very cool to kind of read a comic that's right after it. And yeah. So it's just part of the ethos. Like, everyone knows about V'ger, and even the Klingons on their way to Earth to find out more about this entity was a cool concept. It definitely felt very classic Star Trek to, you know, start this series with a Klingon versus the Enterprise battle.
Yes. And that was because Paramount rejected my original idea. The original idea for issue number 1 was going to be kind of like Star Trek versus aliens. And they were going to encounter an alien race very much like the ones from Aliens. And they were going to get, like, you know, they're going to get their asses kicked. I mean, Kirk, it was on a landing party, and Kirk and Spock and the rest of the landing party were going to get cocooned by these aliens, and Kirk was going to have that crisis of confidence. You know, was I too old to get back into the center seat? You know, I'm jeopardizing the whole mission because I'm rusty and all that. So the dilemma for Kirk was going to be consistent. That ended up in the final version of issue number 1 also, but the story itself, Paramount felt it wasn't Star Trek-y enough. So we went back to the drawing board, and that was basically a scenario that Tim and I worked out. I remember going over that with Tim, and what we got was what we ended up with. But yeah, I mean, V'ger was a big deal. I mean, in the Star Trek universe, V'ger should have been a big deal. And so right on the heels of that, you would be referring to V'ger. And it certainly was – it was the most important Spock story up to that point, in that mm-hmm. it's where Spock was able to unite his two halves into one whole and basically give up the struggle. He doesn't have to struggle anymore. He is a complete person as a result of his – mind meld with V'ger. We see it in Star Trek 2, where Spock is very comfortable with himself. And there's not that conflict raging within him anymore. So Star Trek: The Motion Picture and the whole V'ger encounter was a major event in Star Trek and in the lives of the characters. At least it should have been. The reason why it was never referred to again is because you know, Paramount wanted to distance itself from that movie. They were not happy with it, with the way it performed. They were not happy with the fan reaction, and so they wanted to really sort of pretend it, you know, it didn't happen. But hey, it did. And as for picking up with the motion picture left off, then yeah, the first 2 pages is the end of literally the end of Star Trek: The Motion Picture, and mm-hmm. then we launch into my story. And I remember when the first issue came out, Chris Claremont came up to me and said, "How come I didn't reference his graphic novel, Star Trek: Debt of Honor, which also had a sequence that picked up where Star Trek: The Motion Picture left off," and. I was like, "Hey, Chris, if I'm going to choose between my story and yours, it's going to be mine. So get out of here." You know. so yeah.
I will say that first splash page of that first issue, when you have the Enterprise, like, man, that's a great shot. Like, that's Collins did a great job, really, kind of making that work, because you can really feel that moment.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he was great. My working with Mike was great, and I wish we could have had another go at it. You know, we could have done, you know, Star Trek: Untold Voyages 2, where maybe we do the same format but just different stories, set 1 year. You know, and or like I said, maybe we could have done a 12 issue thing. We could have done more we could have done some multi-parters. But working with Mike, like I said, it was such a pleasure working with other guys who understood Star Trek just as well as I did and can bring things to the table. You know, I mean, the last issue, I ended up getting a little bit of writer's block, and I knew what I wanted the Kirk story arc to be. which was how does he end up back at the Admiralty? How does he end up going back to being an admiral when all he wanted in Star Trek the Motion Picture was to remain a captain? So how does he end up back in that situation that he didn't want to be in? So I knew that that was going to be the story arc. I couldn't come up with a story. And I was starting to panic. And I said to Tim, I just explained to Tim what I just explained to you. I said, I don't got a story. And Tim looked at me and goes, the Preservers. And I was like, got it. I literally, that's how it went. And he was like, he said, the Preservers. And I went, got it. And I went back to my desk and started writing the story. That's what it was like between, you know, me and Tim working together.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if the Preservers, I don't know if that means anything to you, if you know what that reference means.
It doesn't mean as much to me. I apologize.
Well, they did an episode called The Paradise Syndrome. And in that episode, they established that there was an ancient race of space travelers called the Preservers, and they would go from planet to planet, and if the native life form on that planet was in danger of dying out, the Preservers would take samples of that life form and put it on another planet so where it could thrive. And in this one particular episode, The Paradise Syndrome, we found that the Preservers planted a tribe of American Indians from centuries ago. And the planet was within the range of this asteroid field. So the Preservers planted this obelisk, this asteroid deflector, to protect the Indians if an asteroid was going to strike the planet. So that was it. That was the concept of the Preservers, is this alien race that takes species from certain planets and puts them on others to preserve them. So my idea, just based on Tim saying the Preservers, was, well, what if there's another alien race that feels that by doing that, the Preservers are disrupting the natural flow of those planets?
Interesting.
You know, if you take a species from another planet and plant it on another planet, Now you're disrupting the natural flow of events on that planet, because that species is not native to that world. So I created this other species that's been basically going around space trying to undo what the Preservers had done.
It's a fun concept.
Yeah, and it was just a two-word line from Tim. Thank God, because that inspired me, and right there I had a story, and it just fell into place from there. We had a great working relationship that did not last near long enough, because he and I, you know, we were really simpatico on the projects that we worked on, and Mike Collins was just great. He, like I said, he brought so much to the table and added just these little flares that really enhanced the whole thing.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention as well, I mean, obviously Keith Williams on inks, but Matt Webb, the colorist, really does some amazing color work, especially in that shot I mentioned from the first issue,
when you
first see the Enterprise. Like, that's – the colors are – I mean, the fact that they're using the color effect that you had for the warp effect, like that
– yeah,
that is not an easy effect to make work.
No, it's not. It's something that I don't think the original Marvel series from the late 70s, you know, tried to do something similar, but they didn't quite have the technology back then. But yeah, the whole team was great. Chris Aliopoulos did some great sort of design work with the lettering, the fonts, and the way that he distinguished each character. You know, when it was a caption, he would distinguish each character so that you knew who was talking. Everybody brought their A game, and it was one of the most rewarding experiences I have ever had as a writer, and certainly one of the top two experiences I had in comics, writing comics.
So I promise I am going to let you go, but I do have a question, because you're writing a comic, and comics obviously have a different language that you can use. So I'm curious what it's like for you to use thought bubbles on Star Trek characters, because again, that's unusual. Like, usually we're used to hearing voiceover in terms of captain's log, that kind of stuff, right? But generally right. speaking, they're either speaking it or that's it. But now you're actually able to project into their actual thoughts. So what was that like? Because that's obviously much more of a, well, something you'd see in prose, obviously, but also in comics, and not something in the actual medium that, you know, Star Trek's known for and in TV and movies. So what was it like injecting that little bit of comic bookiness and actually having actual thought bubbles for these characters? You didn't use it a lot, but you did use it sometimes.
I did use it sparingly. And I'll tell you something, Adam. If I were to do that series again today, I probably wouldn't have used thought balloons at all. I probably would have found ways to get that information across without thought balloons, because you are trying to recapture the feel of the TV show or the movie, movies, and TV shows and movies, you're not privy to the character's thoughts that way through thought balloons. But at the time, at least when I first started the series, I was a big proponent of thought balloons because I felt like that was one of the advantages that comics have over TV shows and movies. And so given the circumstances, it would have been difficult for me to convey Kirk's thoughts any other way besides thought balloons. Had I been writing a novel, I probably would have had the same exact text, except it would have been "he thought" or "he mused," you know. But it would have been the same exact, you know, text that I wrote. It was a rarity. I did consciously try not to overdo it. But if I remember correctly, the place where I really used it was in the first issue, where it was really Kirk in the midst of battle, having all these thoughts going through his head. And there was just there was no other way that I could think of doing it. I think nowadays I would at least try to do it a different way. And maybe Adam, maybe I would have fallen right back onto thought balloons, because let's face it, it is a comic book. Why not use the tools that are available to you?
Well, exactly.
When you're writing a comic book.
Absolutely. So I have a question about something you said earlier about the, you know, that failed pitch that kind of was like Aliens. When you, I'm assuming, because I'm pretty sure you watched it, when you got to the second last episode of Strange New World Season 1, when they had the Gorn eggs and it was very much like an Alien thing, did you have flashbacks to your rejected plot?
Not really, because you know why? Because they were using established Star Trek lore. I mean, they twisted and turned and manipulated the Gorn to turn it into basically an alien riff. My take was not to use the Gorn. My take was for it to be a completely new alien species.
True.
And it would have been probably a lot more like Aliens, you know, which now that I think about it, I mean, Claremont kind of beat me to it with that Dead of Honor graphic novel that he did, which had quite a bit of like an alien kind of feel to it. If I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I read it, but I think that there was a bit of an alien kind of riff in there. So he might have actually beaten me to it, but I was kind of like going to do my own take on it. But no, I don't think I made the connection, believe it or not. The connection that I made to Strange New Worlds was, I think they did an episode about instantaneous communication throughout the galaxy. If I'm not mistaken, and that one really, I was like, oh my god, you know, it's not like I thought, oh my god, they're ripping me off. I was like, oh my god. An idea that I beat them to it. You know, I beat them to that idea, that kind of thing. That I got very excited about. And I mean, did you watch Strange New Worlds?
Yeah.
Okay, so they did an episode about some kind of way to create instantaneous communication throughout the galaxy, right? Am I mistaken?
No, I'm pretty sure you are right. I'm trying to think which one it was, but I believe you're correct.
Okay, and I think wasn't there another episode that was about trying to prevent an asteroid from striking a planet? Maybe.
Yes.
Okay, so that was another one. Where? Yeah. So Yeah, I think I was excited about that too. I mean, they had different outcomes. They had different. The particulars were different, but the concepts. I mean, I know for sure I beat them to it. So that was exciting, definitely exciting. But the aliens thing, no, I don't remember making that connection.
Interesting. Yeah, it was the first thing I thought of when you're talking about it. I'm like, oh, that seems just like that episode. But you're right. Obviously, it's different because, you know, they're using the Gorn and they're kind of manipulating it to their ends to do a more probably direct riff on aliens.
Yeah.
Well, again, Glenn, thank you so much for taking so much of your time to talk about this series. And also, personal thanks, because you actually helped some of these issues actually get into my hands, because you actually sent them to me. So I very much appreciate that. It was a great read. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. I love to hear that. I'm very gratified that you enjoyed it and that you feel it holds up after all these years. I mean, I'd like to think that I could probably do it better today with all the stuff that I've learned about writing since then. But you know, I looked at them not too long ago and I didn't cringe. So that's a good thing.
That's a mark of success, right?
I think so.
Well, again, thank you so much for coming back and for doing this deep dive into Star Trek Untold Voyages. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.